Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to episodes of the Socially Distanced Sports Bar early and ad-free.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Hey, welcome to the Socially Distanced Sports Bar Part 2 for this week, episode 220. The documentary that we are going to look at is about motor racing. And it is about Nigel Mansell, who, up until I watched this documentary, was just part of the background of sports. Somebody mentioned Nigel Mansell. I can picture him immediately. I can see the Williams car that he drove, and he was just part of my upbringing. Now, I really, really, really like him. So Williams and Mansell Red 5 is the documentary that we'll look at this week. Ellis's book choice for this week is In Chalet United, which is just, it sounds like an amazing book. And immediately when Ellis started talking about it, I downloaded it onto my Audible so I can listen to it while I'm out running this week. So if you are so inspired to give Nuruddin Chowdhury a bit of your money as well, then please feel free to do so. If you have a minute and a half of your life spare, and you will click on the episode description, the top link, and you will vote for us at the British Podcast Awards for this year, we will be very, very, very grateful. All you need to do is click on it, search for the Socially Distant Sports Bar, click on that. You then put in your email address. It sends you an email to confirm that you're not a robot. Click on that and your vote will count. Thank you very much for doing so. And thank you very much to those people who have already done so. As ever with the part twos, if you haven't listened to part one, please go back on the timeline, scroll back a little bit, and listen to part one, because there are always little throwbacks in there. There are always little bits that it helps if you've listened to part one to get the narrative flow of the mood we were in that day. Episode 220, part two, is with you right now.
With Audible, there's more to imagine when you listen. Whether you listen to stories, motivation, expert advice, any genre you love, you can be inspired to imagine new worlds, new possibilities, new ways of thinking. And Audible makes it easy to be inspired and entertained as a part of your everyday routine without needing to set aside extra time. As an Audible member, you choose one title a month to keep from their ever-growing catalog. Be inspired to explore your inner creativity with Viola Davis's memoir, Finding Me. Find what piques your imagination with Audible. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/imagine or text imagine to 500-500. That's audible.com/imagine or text imagine to 500-500.
Hey, Prime members, have you heard? You can listen to your favorite podcasts ad-free? Good news! With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreepodcasts. That's amazon.com/adfreepodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, documentary time on this week's Socially Distanced Sports Bar. It was my choice this time round. This is motor racing one, as you probably got from a little bit of the end of the first round of clips this week. It is called Williams and Mansell Red 5.
You always had the sense of Frank Williams being this figure in the background, just looking for opportunities.
Motor racing was his life. He loved it.
And very quickly, he got it together.
Birmingham, England in the 1960s and 70s was not terribly glamorous and not really the sort of place you'd expect a Grand Prix star to come from.
You know, he should come from Argentina and be called Juan Manuel Fangio, Alberto Ascari or something, anything, you know, but Nigel Mansell from Birmingham.
We sold everything we own to buy a works drive.
Carlos took one look at him and turned to me and said, yeah, yeah, he's got it, for sure.
Nigel's the best British driver we've had come along in years.
Nigel Mansell has arrived.
I was up and gone. I mean, I was ready to win everything.
There was a worry, I think, in the sport that Nigel was sort of attracting the wrong sort of fans.
He was a bruiser and would do anything to succeed.
You do have four of the all-time greats there in one shot.
There they are, trying to be friendly.
Listen, if you're going to try and kill me, I'm telling you now, I'll kill you.
I was beginning to wonder whether Nigel was jinxed, shall we say.
Did you come that close? And I said, I'm done.
You look at it and you just think, that car has to be quick.
Nigel's coming back to Williams. I said, but he retired. But he's unretiring.
At 39, it was now or never for Nigel.
And he's away. Man and machine finally reunited.
All the memories are flooding back.
We can't drop the ball this time. We can't drop the ball.
I mean, come on, let's get it done.
So, the story of Nigel Mansell's career kind of intertwined mostly with the Williams years, a little bit of Ferrari kind of thrown in there, but brushed over really fast. And a sports person that is such part of my youth, but I don't think I'd ever really analysed much. He just existed, was very good or plucky at what he did, in my mind, and will always be Nigel Mansell. He'll just always be like a mention of someone who was good at motor racing, but I knew nothing really about him.
And the person that your dad references when you're talking about someone driving fast, who's he thinking? It's Nigel Mansell. And if your dad's a little bit older, it would be Stirling Moss.
Yes.
But for me, I've never been a huge fan of Formula One, but I was a big fan of Nigel Mansell, and he was Formula One when I was a kid growing up. More so than Prost or Senna, actually, even though I knew them. And I think because of the way sports television worked at the time, the Grand Prix was on terrestrial telly and I would watch any sport. So I did all of the names of the 80s drivers and the 80s teams like McLaren and Williams and Ferrari, etc. I remember them all. I remember what the cars looked like.
Yeah. No one said Nelson Piquet to me in years. But no. I didn't have to think of what Nelson Piquet was.
Keke Rosberg.
And I had to name a Grand Prix driver on the Five Live show. And Nelson Piquet was the one I came up with. came from nowhere. Because he was part of the thing and he was Mansell's teammate.
It's a fantastic doc, mate.
It's brilliant. It's so good.
Absolutely loved the documentary. And loads of things I didn't realise. Oh, I'd forgotten. I'd forgotten that there was almost like this jinx where he was like destined to never win a Formula One.
Well, I knew about 86 because that gets replayed all the time when at Adelaide, it's all he needs to do is finish in a podium place and he's winning, isn't he, to be world champion. And then his tyre goes with a couple of laps to go and then there's all the sparks and then he drives the car.
Iconic clip that.
It's a really iconic. I didn't realise that it happened to him in 87 and in 91 as well. So he should have been world champion four times, really.
But that's the fascinating bit. And this is, what I would say, there's a proviso on this one, that this is entirely from Mansell's perspective.
Yeah. Do what he reminds me of, Andy Murray.
Because,
I mean, obviously there wasn't the same weight between Fred Perry and Andy Murray for a male British singles champion at Wimbledon. But he would have been the first British champion since James Hunt. But more than anything, he was a genius-level driver at a time when there were four GOATs. Because you had Prost and Senna and Piquet and him in the same way that Murray had Djokovic and Federer and Nadal. So it was those three at one point. And then around 2012, Andy Murray was definitely one of the four. And it was four by that point. Because he won it Wimbledon twice and he won the Olympics as well. And with Mansell, he was unlucky to be around at a time of such talent.
I love the, unsurprisingly to listeners, the whole class side of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it is an extremely wealth-oriented sport. It has to be, because how much things cost.
Yeah.
From the days when it would be like a millionaire Playboy's toy, basically, you know. So you always think of Formula One as being this elite world with very wealthy people, very glamorous women, very suave men. And he is this working class kid with a job.
Which I didn't know.
From the West Midlands.
No, I didn't know that either.
The bit with his dad, it doesn't go into any depth about it.
Yeah.
But his dad gets him started with the carton thing. And then when he's doing an engineering degree, his dad says, if you get your engineering degree, I will buy you a new car, essentially. We'll fund it. And then he gets the degree. And the dad says to him, you know, I need to go get the car, dad. So we're like, I didn't believe that. We can't afford to get you a bloody race car.
Well, he laughs at him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he didn't speak to his dad.
Yeah.
Which I found really weird.
I think that's the bit of his personality then that you have to, because it's made in Nigel's favour. Mm-hmm. I think all the voices are kind of in his favour, in my opinion anyway, favour. I think you have to read into that. And the bit where he says, I think it's when Piquet is his other driver within the Williams team. I think he starts talking about messages that he's getting into his helmet from the pit crew. And he says, oh yeah, sometimes the race radio didn't work. And you kind of get in the, that I think that drive and that selfishness and that I'm the best element, I think is slightly underplayed in this. But if you look at the subtext, it's definitely there.
I suppose you have to have it, isn't it?
I don't think it's necessarily a criticism of any sports person either.
Mm.
Because I think, they'll all have had it.
I hadn't realised he'd had such awful injuries.
And
hadn't realised. And again, I mean, I used to love this stuff, but now I've got kids. And also now I'm at an age where some people have really hurt themselves and they're still suffering with it.
Hmm.
I think I'm less enamoured with the side of it where he breaks his back really badly.
Yes.
And then he's offered the chance to drive a Formula One car for the first time. And he's in Formula 4 at the time, or Formula 3, and he's trying to make the step up. And he's asked to do a test drive in a Formula 1 car, having broken his back like 3 weeks previously or something insane.
Hmm.
So he rings his specialist up and he says, can I drive a Formula 1 car next week? And the guy says, no.
No.
Of course he can't. That would be madness.
That's thick.
And he says, definitely not. He goes, yeah.
Yeah.
So he removes his cast and just takes a load of painkillers and turns up and drives the car. And then it happens again. I mean, he breaks his back again in the sort of late 80s.
Hmm.
He doesn't get a feeling back in his legs for months. He's in a Japanese hospital for 3 or 4 months and he's back racing.
When he wins the title and he shattered his foot.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they go to see the fella. He says, we'll need to take all the bits of bone splinter out.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to take ages to rehab this. He said, is there any other way around it? He said, well, you can let it go and eventually the bone splinters will come through the skin.
Yeah, they'll surface.
He said, but it'll be excruciatingly painful.
Yeah.
He said, well, we'll do that then.
Yeah.
But don't tell anyone I've seen you because otherwise they'll take away my license.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've seen when he finally wins it, he can fully go a limp then because he's won it.
Yeah.
But he's really, when he gets that title in 92,
yeah,
you can see the pain he's in just walking.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
I was thinking shards of your own bone coming through your skin.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck it.
And he's saying, well, I'll just pull them out.
Stuff that. Yeah.
Oh, what a fucking nutcase.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also unable to tell anyone because then they would take his license off. So all the time he's walking around pretending he hasn't got shards of his own balls sticking out of his skin.
You're right, Nigel.
Yes! Yes!
Stubbed my toe earlier. Just stubbed my toe. Fucking bone.
Stubbed my fucking toe again!
Fucking.
Got a veruca!
Really hurts, actually.
Just
I stood on a plug in my hotel room! Again!
With my athlete's foot, this really hurts.
You don't see it so much these days, that carting way into Formula One.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same, like when I love Barry Sheen, but he was a real working class. It was always a little bit more working class motorcycling because of the expensive ball, but it was still like it wasn't a poor boy's game. But he was he wasn't a wealthy bloke. His old man was his team, essentially. I mean, he started off, working his way up through the bike ranks.
Mm.
In these days, you could, like if you're a young lad from Bristol, you could get 34 quid off your nan and gram.
Yeah.
And put a new engine in your go-kart, essentially.
Yeah.
And race in the British kart racing thing.
But these
days... And that
was your... Yeah, I know drivers who've tried to do this journey and their parents have spent, or whoever it is, has spent, almost $500,000 on a karting career.
That's crazy, mate.
So the finances involved in it now and, drivers getting up to, Formula Ford, Formula 3 sort of levels... and just never going to have a chance of making it because they haven't got the finances behind them for the F1.
Well, the fellow who I was getting somebody worked on one of my cars, that's his son's a really good kart racer, and he's moved up. But he's got the big mobile home there. And he had to take months and weeks of his own off work and get people around the place. And, you know, you're already like 200 grand into that journey.
Yeah.
And if you're not a millionaire, or you haven't got millionaire backers, what are you going to do? Like, it's...
Yeah.
The way they did the parallel run it with Williams as well. I love that. Like, when he's saying, who's got the money? The Saudis. Right. Well, I'm going to park my car outside the hotel where I know the prince is staying. I'll bribe a traffic warden. I'll go into the lobby. I'll tell him to look out the window.
Yeah.
I'll paint it in Saudi Arabian airline colours.
Yep.
See what happens. And he becomes... What a way of doing it.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Amazing.
He said, well, so we now think about, you know, Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi and all these things as being part of Formula One. He said, but he started that. Mm. There was nothing there before that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, he had a terrible accident.
Yeah. Fucking hell, yeah.
Frank Williams. I only remember him in a wheelchair. I don't remember the accident. The thing with the driving with the broken back, if one of my kids did that, I would be heartbroken and devastated because it's so irresponsible. But we've watched so many documentaries about sports people who've had awful injuries and are playing through it because it's they think that it's their chance to win the title or win the championship or whatever.
And also, mate, partners who, like his wife, can you imagine now, right? You've met, you're both young, you get together, you know, you've got this dream that you want to be a Formula One driver, be a racing kart, or whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
You get married young, you get your first house. It all goes tits up because you got stitched up by that one team who basically you chucked money at it, and then you sell your house, you sell all your furniture, you sell everything you own, the two of you, and live in like rented digs to finance your, and it was a dream to be a Formula One driver.
Yeah.
The fact they're still, well, this was last year, they've now been married 50 years, those two.
Yeah.
I love that. But she must have, Christ.
Do you know what though? Again, we've watched loads of documentaries where the wife sacrifices absolutely everything for the husband to fulfill his ambitions and his dreams in whichever sport it might be.
Mm.
I have never, ever, and we're now 220 episodes in, seen a documentary about a female sports person where, my husband, he sacrificed everything.
Mm.
Like Mansell's wife, and also she was involved in it, in that Nelson Piquet, to get in Mansell's head would be insulting her in the press.
Yeah.
Across well there, did he?
Fucking hell.
What a wanker's trick that is.
It was basically showing off about being a shagger himself and then saying,
I'm trying to be supermodels and he's, you know.
She's not asked to be part of this. Why? He's involving her. I mean, Mansell, tempers are frayed in the pit because of the dangers. So many of those drivers died. And when, I read his Wikipedia, he did have a proper punch up with Senna, I think at Silverstone, because he said, listen, you're going to fucking kill me if you keep driving like this. I will be dead and it's your fault. Yeah, he hit him. And then they sort of shook hands. He said, we either die together or we treat each other with a little bit more respect.
Great line that, though.
Yeah. Because it's such a dangerous sport.
But he says, I will go.
If you're going to kill me, I will take you into that wall with me.
Yeah.
But he's also got... It's an interesting... That's an interesting quote given, you know, how Senna passes away.
Yeah, that he's, a couple of years later as well.
Yeah, but there's also no part of Mansell's brain that goes, maybe I shouldn't say it like that. Do you know what I mean? I think that speaks to all motor racing drivers. I don't think that anyone would go, I don't think any of them would go, that sounds a bit wrong, actually, given... But they've just got a different mindset where some of your mates will die.
Have you seen Senna?
The film? Yes.
Yeah. That is one of the best sports documentaries I've ever seen in my life, I think.
Mm. We haven't done that.
I'm amazed we haven't done Senna.
No, it's cracking.
We'll have to do it.
Yeah. I had no preconceptions of what Nigel Mansell was like, except, interestingly, you mentioned Andy Murray, except that I assumed he would be boring. And I don't know why I thought he was boring.
Yeah.
I think maybe the tone of his voice, I'm not quite sure what it is, but something about him, maybe it was a British media thing, maybe he was painted as being boring.
I think you've got that West Midlands, that Birmingham accent. You're always portrayed as either a bit boring or a bit thick, which is really unfair because I love, I think Birmingham is a great place. It's a great night out. They're good. They're funny people.
Yeah.
You know, you think like, I did this thing with Tim Spall the other day and he's a really nice bloke. Yeah. You know, very, when he wanted the sort of, you know, Betty, you know, Alvida's Ain't Pep, which I'm watching again.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Let's give him a really thick Brummie accent and that'll make him, you know,
yeah,
laughable or, you know.
But, you know, he's also competing in a sport where, I don't know, James Hunt would probably have been the previous British winner.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Graham Hill or Jack. It's that sort of era of elite, you know.
Oh, millionaire playboys.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, guys who came across as a, you know, a posh laugh.
And he says that. There's other people there admitting that Damon Hill's saying there was a lot of snobbery involved.
Yes. And that's coming from Damon Hill, who was Graham Hill's son.
Exactly.
So, you know, came from a motor racing family with a lot of money behind them.
Yeah. And you get into that world and, you know, you're an upstart. You're a working class Brummie who suddenly, you know, down at the top table with those boys. They must have hated it, some of them.
And he was loved by the British public.
Yes.
Do you wish that bit when he filled up talking
the only about time in the whole programme?
He's pushing 70 now.
Mm.
And he properly fills up, saying he did it for...
It's the bit where he doesn't win the F1 World Championship, but he wins BBC Sports Personality of the Year.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, which is a far bigger accolade in
I think he generally believes that.
Yeah, I think he does, actually.
Yeah.
And Steve Ryder, I knew he'd won it in 86, BBC Sports Personality, and I knew that he'd... I remember Adelaide... Because it's, you know, if you've been watching sport in Britain over the last 30 years, you have seen that footage.
Yes.
And Steve Ryder says, obviously he doesn't win the World Championship, but he wins a whole host of other things. I thought, don't say Sports Personality, Steve. Fucking hell. And he does.
He's got the trophy behind him while he's doing the interview as well, Steve.
Because now I think we're quite jaded about that now.
Yes.
I am, certainly.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was a kid in the 80s watching.
Oh, it's a big deal, man. Yeah,
yeah. That was the big thing to win.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it meant a lot to people. Well, it meant a lot to him. Christ.
Yeah. I would say as looks go, Steve looks exactly like Steve Ryder. Nothing's changed about Steve Ryder.
Well, I said on the WhatsApp group, mate, he just revealed he's got prostate cancer before Christmas, didn't he?
Okay, I didn't know.
Hopefully he'll get through that.
Mm.
Very treatable and all that sort of stuff. Mm. I love Steve Ryder.
Same.
And he's so good on this. He looks the same. He's 74 years of age.
I know.
He
looks the same.
He's 74.
Mansell looks amazing.
How?
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is looks wise.
And he's 70. Well, he's 69.
Nigel has made the executive decision to grow the moustache back.
Looks much better for it. Am I wrong?
And now looks like Nigel Mansell again.
He looks like Nigel Mansell. He looked after that other moustache.
He hasn't got a hint of grey.
No.
I've said before, once you're known for a moustache, you can't shave it off.
Yeah.
You can for a role, then grow back again. You won't look right. If he never had one, there's that photograph of him early on. I've never seen him as a young man without the moustache. And he's there with his wife.
Mm.
He was a handsome bastard, mind as well. Mm. You know, clean shaven. He had that little blue top on with a side part in jet black hair, him and his wife. And he probably would have been, 20 years of age.
Yeah.
Good looking boy. I only ever saw him with a moustache as a kid.
Yeah.
And as a young adult. I was 20 when he won the F1. So then when he shaved it off then, I thought, you look wrong, mate.
Mm.
Yeah.
Get that moustache back on. I know he's got it back on. He looks fantastic. He's there at Goodwood.
Mm.
Like he's 69 years of age. When he puts the classic old overalls on as well, which I love, those blue Adidas racing shoes. Yes, please,
please.
He looks the business.
When he burns his buttocks...
Oh,
fuck. How much
that is?
I'm a
ghoulies. Ghoulies, yes. Yeah.
No.
I haven't heard the word ghoulies in 30 years.
No F1 world champion, apart from Nigel Mansell, has ever said the word ghoulies.
Not kidding.
I defy you to find a clip. Ayrton Senna talking about his ghoulies.
Because I read about this, right? Because it didn't make sense to me. I read about it. I had to Google Nigel Mansell burnt buttocks, and there are lots of articles about it. So there's a fuel leak which catches fire and he's sitting in the fire.
Yes.
So his team pour water on him so he's sitting in the water because he's not given the opportunity to get out of the car.
No.
And he's not given the opportunity to not race.
No.
So he has to do racing. The whole thing with first degree burns on his buttocks and testicles.
Incredible.
Yeah.
His pain threshold is fucking mental.
They have to have that.
They're
a different breed, those people.
But I drove with a coffee cup between my legs the other day and I spilt it. And No burns at all, I'll be honest. But warm, and around the groin area, warmness.
Yeah.
And I've stained my jeans. That was enough to put me off driving for a little. I would say that driving down that dual carriageway was not my best driving.
Yeah, first thing, we spilled a McDonald's hot coffee on yourself on a roundabout.
Yeah, oh, that hurts.
Imagine doing a two-hour race after that.
At 200 miles an hour.
Imagine doing a two-hour race after that, but they've also set fire to the coffee.
And they've set fire to your jeans.
Yeah.
And if you make a mistake, you're dead.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you've got to drive home at 200 miles an hour. What?
And eat a double cheeseburger.
With your fucking ghoulies on fire.
My ghoulies hurt.
God. Different world, man. That car, though, that 92 car. Mm. There's two I remember. His car, that red 5.
Yes.
And then I had when I was a kid, I had the Marlboro. Like a
had one beautiful of those.
Metal die-cast one. Should have kept that. I don't know where that is somewhere. Would have been from about 76. Well, it was probably the James Hunt car.
Yeah, could well be.
Maybe.
My uncle was mad into his F1, and I used to get these cars as Christmas presents all the time. So these are just totally in my head.
Have you still got them?
I don't know. Probably.
I'll find them.
Yeah, probably. I was a big fan. Yeah, loved all this stuff.
Don't really get it. I would never sit and watch F1.
Not now, but I would in this era, yes.
Oh, I used to all the time.
But I used to, and also...
Yeah, even at uni I would. Doom, yeah.
Doom.
They're great stories.
I remember sat at Mum and Dad's house when I was about 14. I was going through the album collection, trying to expand my mind a little bit. And I put on Rumours by... Leo Mac.
Yeah.
The Chain came on.
Mm.
And it blew me away.
Halfway through. You're like, what?
Doom, doom, doom. What is going on here?
Why on earth have they put that in this? It feels really weird. It's a weird decision. It's like getting halfway through Sergeant Pepper's and comes in. And you're like, what? Why would they have done that?
I don't watch any Formula One now.
I haven't in ages.
But that was a... Talk about a golden... It was terrestrial TV.
Mm.
It was Fleetwood Mac, The Chain.
Yeah.
Like I said, there was Prost, Piquet, there was Senna.
Yeah.
Mansell.
Yeah.
There was Murray Walker doing the comms.
Yeah.
I mean, that's as good as it gets.
And I didn't care in that era, even though I knew that there were team tactics, and I also knew that some cars were better than others, even within teams.
Yeah.
I didn't give a shit at that age. Whereas now, if someone talks to me about F1... I'll be like, oh, yeah, but they actually, so you find the car and, you know, they've actually got to hold back then, even though they're teammates.
But the fact that it's a competition between manufacturers, and I know that that's exciting, but the problem is, as a layman, if you think, well, if you're in a shit car, you can't win the Grand Prix, you can't win.
Yeah.
And everyone knows which the best cars are.
But I didn't care.
I would like the cars to be exactly the same, because then it's a real test of your driving abilities.
But then you'll never get. There'll never be the money to do that.
No.
Yeah.
There's nothing in it.
It's all about pushing the innovations, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's the bit when he gets in a PK's car and realizes he's swapped cars on him.
Yes.
He's been set up not for him. And he just goes out there and wins in his car anyway. I love that bit.
Mm.
Yeah. Where's my car? Well, Nelson wanted your car.
It's for qualifying, isn't it? He gets out of the car and goes, which fucking car have I got for the race then?
yeah, come on.
Love it.
I'm the best in both of them. It doesn't matter to me. And stuff, I didn't realise that tactics had changed. Like when he's saying a lot of that stuff now, you'd have like a stop-start penalty for that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's true. I'll be honest. I think that's his own interpretation of that for me.
You can still hold the line, can't you? There's nothing...
Well, exactly. I think he's basically just... He's just blocking him out. He's parking the bus, for want of a better metaphor.
But they mention it briefly on here.
Yeah.
And they talk about the Monte Carlo race.
Yes.
And it's the biggest criticism of Formula One. They're saying if you're on pole, basically, you almost always will win, because you can't overtake a Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
Then what's the point if you can't overtake? And that's why I started watching bike racing, because you would see... Just by the nature of a bike, it's much easier to go past someone on a bike than it is in a car.
Yeah.
In a super wide... And when you see those cars up close, Formula One cars, they're really, really low, but they're really, really wide.
Yeah.
Are we going to go past them on a street, like a street circle in Monte Carlo? You can't happen. It doesn't happen much on the tracks.
Yeah. I think Mansell comes across in this in such a nice way that he seems like a really nice person to me.
You said you wish to use your uncle after this.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think...
Perfect summing up of it.
You wouldn't want him to be your dad?
No.
Because I just don't think he'd do a great job, personally. Yeah. I think he's too focused on his own career. So, but I think as an uncle, he'd be, oh yeah, Nigel Mansell's my uncle. It's fucking cool. Yeah. It's fucking cool.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, yeah. It's good lad.
Good lad. Good lad. Comes across a bit miserable, but he's
loads of good stories.
Yeah. Loads of good stories about his ghoulies. Uncle Nigel uses the word ghoulies a lot. But apart from
the
that.
The fella there who, and his name escapes me, which is Paul, who died. That Mansell says, like, he was like,
yes,
a father figure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like from the Lotus team. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. He looked the best. He looked like Graham Hill, dashing.
Mm.
And he was like 54 when he died. Yeah. Wow.
I thought it was interesting with Nigel Mansell. He had an engineering degree.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So he was able to discuss, you know, in intimate detail with the mechanics stuff about the cars that the other drivers couldn't, because they had just come up through, you know. But he really understood the science of it, which gave him a certain edge.
Yeah.
He was always just the English one or the British one.
Yeah.
And he would often win Silverstone, you know, British Grand Prix, and he would often be very, very unlucky and not be the world champion.
Yeah. Mm.
That was my memory of Nigel Mansell. Because I remember when Damon Hill won the F1 World Championship in about 96, I remember Murray Walker in tears at the end.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But he was down as well, didn't
he?
Yeah, because Walker didn't cry when Mansell won it.
I think he'd known the Hill family since Damon was a
Yeah,
kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Hill says he's one of the all-time greats. He's one of the all-time great drivers, Mansell.
Well, I remember going to IndyCar and winning it the first year.
Yes,
well, that's what I was going to say, winning that series the year after. Mm. So he isn't mentioned.
Well, he went the year after?
Yeah. The year
after. Just money?
I think that there was some contractual dispute with Williams after this, where I don't think they re-signed him straight away, but I think they re-signed his teammate. And I think he just thought, fuck you then. And he went to IndyCar, won that series.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, cool. If you can win F1 and you can win the Indy series, then you are...
Same year. Yeah. The same 12 months.
You're good at driving.
You are good. You're good at driving. You're good at driving, you are, Nige.
Nige is good at driving.
Yeah. That's what I took away from this.
Goodwood looks... I've never been to Goodwood. A lot of my friends have been to Goodwood.
Yeah.
I enjoy Goodwood.
I've never been. No.
Looks like my cup of tea. They do that Festival of Speed.
Well, they play punk music. Everyone takes amphetamines.
Yeah, everyone's just off their tits. Big old Festival of Speed.
Everyone's teeth are fucked.
A lot of chewing gum sales.
Yeah, there's dentists there as well. Emergency dentists.
Does that annoy
you? Make you grind your teeth?
Hmm?
All the time.
Yeah.
Hmm? Yeah.
Or speed, though.
Yeah.
What was that?
A lot of ratty faces.
Yeah.
You won't want a festival, on it, to be honest. I think that'd be an awful weekend away.
Festival of Speed.
Festival of Whiz.
Whiz Stock.
Just think Whiz Stock. Amfetta
Fest.
That's what you want, isn't it? E Stock. It'd be great.
Yeah. He does come across very, very well in this.
He does. Yeah. And looks good. And yeah, just is emotional to the right levels where he looks like he's repressed it for years. And then cries a little.
Because he's won Sports Personality of the Year.
He's Guerrero-esque for 95% of this documentary.
He's very earnest, and then,
He goes briefly Bubbins, and then he's back to Guerrero again.
Yeah.
Very, very briefly Bubbins, and then does what all British males of that era should do, blames it on the pollen.
Yeah, I know it's that. Yeah.
Apologises.
Yeah, sorry, it must be the pollen.
His body, he must be in pieces in the morning. When you think about his injuries.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? Yeah. Mm. Yeah. The back would probably, you know, no amount of yoga or Pilates is going to go for. What, do you have concussion of the spine?
Spinal concussion. I never even heard of it.
That sounds awful.
He's paralyzed for like three or four months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone seems fine about that. The journals are just reporting on it like, yeah, Mansell's still in hospital in Japan with spinal injuries. What? Can't feel his legs for 4 months. Yeah.
I'd always liked him, but he'd always just been there.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He's just a bit of British sport.
Well, you can see his relationship. You can always tell, right? There was a little parallel with, sorry to talk about Mammoth again, but on the last day of filming, everyone had stick-on moustaches on.
Yeah.
The camera crew, the lovely sound crew.
Lovely.
It was just a nice little touch. Yeah. Right? And that bit when all his little crew there, all had the little moustaches and stuff. When he goes back to Goodwood and meets those people.
Respect is moustache related for you, yes?
Just
for the record, Fuxia. If people are putting on comedy moustaches, they like you.
No, that's the all people that you work with, if the people you work with enjoy your company and like spending time with you.
Yes.
And it's a bit more than just a job.
Yes.
then that tells you what that person's like. So when you see that, when you see him there with that, with his crew, you just know that he's a decent bloke because of the way that people he's worked with in really fucking high pressure situations.
On Steph's last day at the BBC, everyone had an eyeball beard.
It was a massive Evan beard.
Grew their back hair especially.
Going to part it forward from my back to celebrate.
You know, you just see, like, and he's giving all the sort of crew a hug, and the fellow who's in charge of the bald bloke, was he marketing? I can't remember who it was for now.
He's kind of like, he's part of the Williams.
He'd been a journalist, hadn't he? Yeah.
But a journalist as well, yeah.
PR and marketing and stuff. Yeah. You can see that he holds him in great esteem and great affection.
Yeah.
I love that.
But I think because he'd been let down by things that were beyond his control at crucial moments, that had prevented him from being the world champion when he probably was the best driver in the world. And that had happened three times.
Yeah.
I think him eventually winning it in 92, like I vividly remember him winning it in 92. And it was a bit like Wales qualifying for a tournament after 58 years. It was this enormous sense of relief that finally, or Murray winning Wimbledon, finally he could say that he'd done it and he was the world champion. Or like Liverpool winning the Premier League title, you know, during COVID. Finally, they've got there. And I think that he means an awful lot to the people who worked for him, because he is clearly a nice bloke in a very high pressure situation. So I think that that's very telling.
But there's another bit when he talks about the fella giving him the bollock in, like, you know, turn a strip off him. But that's fine if you've got that relationship.
Yeah.
You knew he was going to come back in the pits and get absolutely bollocked for something, and then that did happen. The bit when he says about, he knew there was, he could feel a rattle and he knew something was going on, and then you're driving out of a pit.
They haven't put the wheel on. They haven't put the wheel on.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
And that's cost you a world championship.
Yeah. So would you then, in the post-race interviews, have the ability, because I don't think I would, to not go, he didn't put a fucking wheel on, did he? To actually not throw someone else under the bus and just to go,
I'm not sure.
These things happen.
If it cost me the world championship, I would like to think, I really would like to...
Speaks volumes about him,
I really
didn't.
Would like to think that I would say, we win as a team and lose as a team. But if I'd lost the world championship because someone hadn't put the wheel on...
That's one fucking screw.
Yeah.
He fucking didn't put a fucking screw in the fucking wheel. The wheel fucking fell off.
I tell you what I found brilliant in this was when he's won it and they're there on the podium, he says, Senna leaned across him and said, you know why I do
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And he says, because this is the greatest feeling in the world.
Mm.
And you'll do anything to feel like this.
Yeah.
And he didn't say, I got it.
Yeah.
But you could tell he did.
Yeah.
100%. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I ride drive on that because I want to feel like this again.
Mm.
This is fucking, you're the Formula One world champion.
Well, they've only,
what a buzz, man.
There have only been 34 Formula One world champions.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that's the bit that stood out for me about the whole thing was like, because I thought he's only won it once. So I wonder how many drivers have won it. But you look at like Piquet and Senna both won it three times. You've got Prost who won it four times in his era.
Schumacher. Loads.
There's only so many. Yeah, Schumacher and Lewis have both won it seven times. Fangio five times.
Vettel, because there's a bit of Vettel at the end as well. When Vettel buys that car, buys Red Fight.
Yeah.
And he comes out of it, it's like, you, I can't believe you drove that car fast.
Yeah.
Because it's scary. Like, you know, he was saying when he sits in there.
You're mad. Mansell says, I was actually. Yeah, I was mad.
A little bit mad.
I was. I used to drive with a broken back. I was mad.
But even like crashing to tyre walls and bloody and hay bales, that doesn't happen now. There's enormous runoffs.
Mm.
I'm not saying it's not dangerous. It is obviously
bloody dangerous, yeah.
But it was markedly more dangerous then.
There's a bit where he sat back in the car, isn't there? And he goes, ooh, you can see how exposed we were.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's no screen.
He sort of has this realisation of shit.
And now they got the sort of thing over the head as well.
The halo thing. Yeah.
There's none of that. Christ, 200 miles an hour. But he says, like, he's 6 seconds off the pace.
Hmm.
And he said, well, where am I going to find 6 seconds? I can't find 6 seconds. And then he literally has that, you know, that Damascene moment where everything suddenly just goes, slows down for him.
Yeah.
And he makes up 6 seconds the next time he went out.
That's mad.
6 seconds at 200 miles an hour. That's a long way.
I'd like to see how slow I could go around an F1 track. I think that'd be quite nice.
The one bit on this that I had a real problem with was when Frank Williams, I wouldn't obviously wish that on anybody, what happened to him, right?
Oh, did.
But to drive a fucking road car at that speed,
yes,
you're a prick, mate.
Yeah.
Right? And if someone's going to get quadriplegic, I'm glad it was you and not your passenger or the poor fucker coming the other way.
Or a pedestrian.
The journalist guy, again, I think he must be working within these environments of high-speed accidents. But even his reflections on that were, we'll see how well you can handle this car now then. Like, we know what happened, mate. He winds up in a wheelchair. It's really matter of fact the way they all talk.
I think it is that, because I think it's a news story. You're just reporting a horrific accident. And I think because they happen all the time.
If you drive fast, that sort of, those mad speeds on a public road, you are, I mean, you're a dick.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, there should be a whole advertising campaign. Whole public safety awareness campaign around the fact that you're just pointing out what a dick that person is.
Yeah.
You know, because you shouldn't have done that. I wouldn't wish fucking quadriplegia on anybody.
No.
But I'd rather it was him than anybody else in that situation. But he was the longest surviving quadriplegia. I didn't realise that.
Didn't know that at all.
He wasn't that old. He's not like 70. He's in his 70s.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. I was a fantastic. I loved this stuff.
Yeah.
So much so, and I went through, there's a couple, there's one on Stirling Moss. I thought about Senna as well. I just thought, they just make such good docs.
Yeah.
They're big personalities, and it's like, it's all, you know, high stakes.
Yeah.
The Senna doc was made by the same people who made Maradona and the one about Amy Winehouse, and it is exceptional. Yes. Yeah, but it is so good.
We can't do it next, we'll have to do it like next, but what else?
We can. We do whatever, it's fine.
Yeah, so fuck's our podcast.
Yeah, do what we want.
Stuck in the Wondery say, can we talk to your people? You're talking to all of our people now.
You're talking to everybody who does everything
this
already.
This is all of our people on this Zoom call.
Yeah, we're all in and we'll relay it to the team.
Yeah. While our people can meet your people and we'll do lunch or something, yeah?
Yeah, that'd be great. Cool. Why is it you three again? So, book time on this week's Distant Pod. Ellis, your choice.
This is a great book, and I'm amazed I didn't get around to doing it when I first read it, which is about a year ago. So I apologise to the author because it's not fresh in my mind, but it had a real effect on me, real impact on me. I think it's a fantastic read. And I was reminded of it because the author, Nuruddin Chowdhury, known to as Noz to his friends when he does the Guardian Football Weekly podcast, and Bearded Genius on Twitter, so a lot of you will follow him on Twitter, is a massive fan of Mammoth. And I saw him tweeting about Mammoth very positively.
He did. So he was very, very nice about it.
And he said, you know, the thing with making a sitcom or writing a sitcom about a 1970s PE teacher, the jokes could be absolutely horrific in the wrong hands.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. And it shone a spotlight on those issues without making some very, very bad choices. And I saw Noz's tweets about Mammoth, and I thought, bloody hell, his book. I never got around to doing that on the book review, so I'm doing it now. It is called Inshallah United, A Story of Faith and Football. And the thing, and what's odd about Nuruddin, I've got a lot of mutual friends with him, and we've worked on the same things at different times. Our paths have never crossed, so I've never met him. So I started following him on Twitter years ago because he was really funny and wise about football. And he seemed to be, from the pictures, very well-dressed. So I thought, that's good enough for me. And then I got sent this book last year and read it and couldn't put it down. So he is a working-class Asian Muslim Mancunian who is about my age, born in 79. So he's growing up in Manchester in the sort of the 80s and 90s. So his teenage years, by which point he's chosen Man United, coincide with Man United being, you know, at times the best team in the world, his teens and 20s. So if you are a working class Asian Muslim Mancunian who ends up, because you're bright, going to a really nice grammar school, you're going to be othered in lots of different ways.
God, yeah.
And fucking hell, he can write. It's a really, really well-written book, and it's really funny, and it's really deft, and it's, I mean, some of the observations he makes, because obviously it's a very different upbringing and background to my own as a Welsh-speaking Westphalian. The school I went to was 100% white. So it's, you know, it's a different background. And I just learned so much from it. I sort of reacquainted myself with the book this morning because it's been a year or so since I read it. But there's a really heartbreaking bit when he's been racially abused in primary school, but because he's so young and naive, he doesn't realise it's happening. It's only much later that he realises what the bloke was doing and saying. So there's lots of stuff about that. But also, what makes relevant to this podcast, you realise the incredibly powerful force that is sport when it comes to assimilating and feeling a part of something. Because he's a Man United fan. And I think it's on the blurb where he says, yeah, I used to pray five times a day. But what I was praying for was that Man United would sign Alan Shearer.
That's funny.
So he's a sort of Morrissey loving, you know, Maggie Thatcher hating working class mank. He writes really.
You had me a Maggie.
Yeah, he writes really.
Sorry.
But he writes really intelligently about Prince Nassim Hamed, because obviously Nassim Hamed had a completely different background to his own. But the thing with immigrants, they tended not to be, or it was very rare that an immigrant was just so arrogant and self-confident.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
know your place sort of stuff.
Exactly. And you know, most, I mean, this is a chapter I read a year ago, but I remember it was huge for him, because he was like, fucking hell, this guy, he's just so aware of his own abilities and he's so confident in his own abilities. And he knows he's the best. And I think it had a big impact on him. The way he writes about family, the stuff he writes about his dad and his family is so poignant. It's a really, really good book. He talks about music, about sort of Mancunian music, sort of talks about his favourite records. There's a lot in it. It's really personal, but also it's kind of bookmarked by Man United being the best team in Europe. So there's a lot of football in there. There's a lot of other stuff. It's a really, really impressive memoir. So I would recommend it very, very highly. It is called Inshallah United, A Story of Faith and Football by Nuruddin Chowdhury.
Follow the Socially Distant Sports Bar on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.